And I'm Phil Latzman. Happy New Year. Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN, our weekly mission to keep South Florida informed on local, regional, state news and issues affecting our entire community with a panel of the area's top journalists. And this week I am joined by McNelly Torres, who is with the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. Welcome back, McNelly.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Chuck Strauss is the editor-chief, the El Jefe, if you will, of the Miami New Times, and also the New Times Broward Palm Beach edition. Chuck, welcome back to you, sir.
Great to see you, Phil.
And Patricia Mazzei, we call her Front Page Patty at the Miami Herald. She's come up with a whole bunch of different stories that have been making news lately, which we'll discuss with her. And she's a reporter with the Miami Herald. Hi, Patty. Welcome back.
Hi, Phil. Happy New Year.
And we will begin with the hanging off the fiscal cliff this week. And since that was the discussion that's been aired nationally, what does it mean for the state and region? It kind of depends on who you talk to. Florida taxpayers will see larger bills this year after Congress voted to allow the 2010 deduction in the Social Security tax to expire. That means a 2% increase in the payroll tax. An economist with the University of Central Florida says that is expected to cost Floridians about $6.5 billion. Sean Snaith told the Herald Times Tallahassee Bureau more than 7 million Florida households would see a tax increase that would cause the state's economy to shrink. And the median Florida household earns $45,000. That could actually pay up to $900 more per year in taxes this year. And we're not alone, obviously, that's around the country. But economist Hank Fishkind says the agreement, combined with other factors, means Florida's economy will continue to recover in 2013.
This lifts a significant weight of uncertainty off of the economy, and thereby will allow for stronger growth in 2013 than would otherwise occur.
None of us on this panel is an economist, and nor do we pretend to be, but do we have a sense, Chuck, as to maybe this deal helps or hurts Florida's economy?
Well, I think it comes at a pretty good time for us. As painful as it is, and my newsroom is abuzz with the fact that everybody's check is smaller today, but in the medium term, you know, house prices have been recovering. The economy has been growing in a way it hasn't for the last 5 years.
And this is something we've just dealt without for a couple of years. It was coming out of our paycheck only a couple of years ago, and now it was out for 2 years and now back in. We're all going to have to get used to that. The other thing that's been talked about is the strain on hospitals. It halted a $30 billion cut in payments to treat Medicare patients, this agreement, but hospitals now have to pick up half the tab over the next 10 years. And there's also $1 billion in cuts imposed by the state in the teaching hospitals and Florida's public hospitals. So there's that, and there's the benefit for the Florida unemployed, which this could be a good thing, is that Congress extended the Federal Emergency Unemployment Compensation Program, meaning about $1.4 billion will be injected into the Florida economy. Long-term unemployment has been a little bit worse here than in elsewhere. So I guess it depends on the way you look at it. What's, Patty, been the political reaction to all this? And we'll go over the roll call in just a moment, but what are the reactions and implications of this agreement for those of us politicians in South Florida?
Well, we had a couple of South Florida members of Congress, Republican members of Congress, voting for the deal, Liana Ross-Layton and Mario Diaz-Balart. So that was interesting because so many House Republicans opposed the deal, including Representative David Rivera and Senator Marco Rubio, most notably. So I think Florida, as usual, is just kind of representing the center of the debate. You had one senator voting for, one senator voting against. The delegation was split, kind of like the country.
Yeah, and Marco Rubio mentioned one of the 8 dissenting members of the U.S. Senate, one of the 5 Republicans that voted against it. And, of course, everybody's looking at that with an eye towards 2016. Is he preparing a run for president? And, of course, Paul Ryan, who was the VP nominee of the Republicans, voted for it. So it's separating them there. Rubio said in a statement, quote, "I cannot support the arrangement they have arrived at. Rapid economic growth and spending reforms are the only way out of the real fiscal cliff our nation is facing. But rapid economic growth and job creation will be made more difficult under the deal reached in Washington." Now, in the meantime, we now have new blood in D.C. as we talk about the South Florida delegation. No more David Rivera or Alan West. Both of them on their way out did vote against the fiscal cliff deal. 3 new Democrats from the region were sworn in yesterday, including Joe Garcia, Lois Frankel, and Patrick Murphy, the former West Palm Beach Mayor Frankel, who represents parts of both Broward and Palm Beach. talked about her priorities as she begins her congressional existence.
First of all, for me, you know, a freshman coming in, most important thing for me is great constituent service. A lot of needs back home, but, you know, just getting people through the federal bureaucracy, whether it's a Medicare issue, Social Security, veterans, benefits, we're going to have a good, high-powered office to help our constituents.
So it looks as if with three new Democrats, Patty, we've got South Florida swinging a little bit more blue and a couple of more radical right-wing members of Congress on the Republican side. Alan West and David Rivera are out.
Well, Alan West did get a couple of votes for the new House speakers, which was interesting. So there's clearly some support among House members still for him there, even though he was no longer in Congress. As it turns out, you don't have to be a member of Congress to be Speaker of the House.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. It was interesting.
Always a fun reminder there. But we'll see how they do. I mean, you know, certainly for Joe Garcia, he's in more of a swing district, slightly more a Democratic this time around. But he's been talking a lot about bipartisanship. I think looking for 2 years down the road, this is a district that's going to want him to get stuff done rather than just throw meat to the base.
A little more progressive now, Chuck?
Oh, more. Lois Frankel is will be interesting to watch because she's a fighter. She's a historic feminist in Florida and across the nation. And I think we're going to see her clawing and scraping in a way that we haven't had South Florida members doing on the Democratic side of that.
I also think that the voters have sent a really strong message during these elections. They are tired of this gridlock in Congress, and they want to see these lawmakers to work together because there's a lot of problems in this country that they need to resolve.
And one of these Congress persons that were sworn in yesterday, all of them, and I think saying the politically correct thing is this, our number one goal is to try and work across the aisle and do that. But guys like Alan West leaving Congress, you wonder, does he think have a political future, Alan West? Do you think we'll see him again?
We'll see him in Fox. I mean, he's not going out quietly. Right. I mean, he's been, you know, bashing Secretary of State Clinton and claiming that, you know, she was faking her illness, clot in the brain. So he's not going out quietly, obviously. But, you know, we'll see him in Fox for sure.
There's always a spot on Fox News for a guy like Alan West. We want to remind you that it's your show, too, and we want to hear from you along the way. One thing we are doing that's pretty special during the show is our Twitter. We're putting a lot of effort into Twitter. I think everybody in the media is, but we would love you to tweet us at WLRN, follow us there, and then you can also go to our Facebook page and post on our new live blog that we've got there. It's a discussion that's hosted by our social media editor, Danny Rivero, and we'd like to hear from you via that medium, and I know we all have our own Twitter accounts. I want to also talk about the amazing story this week, Patty, that you have been covering. It's a story right here happening in our backyard. The Marine from South Dade, John Hammer, from Palmetto Bay, held in Mexico for 4 months, released 2 weeks ago, and now beginning to speak publicly about the kind of peril he was in. You were spent some time with the family in the past 2 weeks. Give us an update on that story.
Well, this story was actually broken by one of our colleagues in McClatchy, which owns the Miami Herald in Mexico, Tim Johnson, who first exposed the case of this Marine veteran who had brought in his great-grandfather's family heirloom shotgun into Mexico. He and a buddy were going to drive through Mexico to get to Costa Rica to surf. And he was stopped at the border, even though he had been told that he could fill out some registration papers for the gun. They said otherwise. They took the gun. They put him in prison and charged him. So he was there for 4 months. The family didn't go public until early December. And a few days before Christmas, he was released. But, you know, he had to go in the hospital. He was dehydrated, had a stomach bug, and finally got out of the hospital and was with his family yesterday. We had a photographer go see him, and he spoke to Tim by phone. It sounds like he's doing better. But, it was a bit of an ordeal for his family in Palmetto Bay, and all his friends really rallied to bring him back.
And he's now beginning to speak publicly about his ordeal, and Tim Johnson from the McClatchy newspaper chain had what looks like an exclusive today in getting him. I'm sure there are other media outlets ready to knock on the door and say, hey, in fact, we probably would be one of them as well. But what is he saying about his experience and what nearly happened to him?
Well, it was, kind of fascinating to read because he said that that he was threatened with being beheaded by some of the other inmates, kind of said, this is how you're going to get out of here. You're going to be dead. You know, there's nothing protecting you. He gave a picture of a prison that was run by inmates rather than by prison guards, by the drug cartels. Certainly his family had already said that they had called to try to extort money from them before he was segregated from the general prison population. So it's just a kind of a harrowing story about what it's like being in prison.
What are Mexican officials saying about all this? Because it seems like there's some culpability there. I mean, how could this happen to an American citizen? He's detained for 4 months in a Mexican prison, threatened with beheading. I mean, and they have no control over that?
Well, I got some emails after writing about this a few weeks ago from folks who said, you know, there's signs in the border that say you can't bring guns. And John Hammer said as much, saying there are also signs that say you can register your weapon. So there seems to be some confusion at the border in terms of what folks might be getting told about bringing guns or not bringing guns. Obviously, and the U.S. says this to citizens when they go abroad, is you have to follow the laws of the foreign country that you're in.
Right. He did break the law, but was that four months
in a prison? Well, but he was apparently told that he wasn't going to break the law. So there's the confusion there. Certainly, he was pulled from the general inmate population when you know, folks here made some noise about it. In fact, he was pulled to an area where he apparently, had he roamed free, he might have been able to escape. So they had to chain him to a bed periodically.
It also seems to be the Mexican government's response, maybe related to the U.S. Government's Operation Fast and Furious, where U.S. government allowed hundreds, maybe even thousands of guns to be smuggled into Mexico. But I don't know, Chuck, you think this is the last we've heard of this story, and we have the local connection here?
I think bringing a gun into Mexico is not a stupid thing. In the end, it's a dangerous place to travel. There are more kidnappings and more danger there than any other country in Latin America.
But at the same time, you know, he's a Marine.
Elliot.
And I'm, you know, speaking for, you know, I was a military wife for 20 years. My husband was in the Army. And when you're in the armed forces, you are taught to follow protocol and follow rules. So I find this story, to me, was a little bizarre when I heard the Marine took a gun to a foreign country without following protocol. So even though the protocol seems to be a little confusing, he should have checked that out before going there. You know, so I think there's more to this story that we are hearing in a lot of respects.
I do think inmates run in the jails in Latin America, not just Mexico, but in countries throughout the northern part of the continent.
They just don't have the control over the prisons.
It's a very common thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
McNelly Torres, Patty Mazzei, Chuck Strauss. I'm Phil Latzman. This is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. We're open for your thoughts on this or anything else that you hear along the way. 800-743-WLRN is our phone number. And again, we'd like to encourage you to follow us at WLRN and then join the live chat on our Facebook page, which is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. When we come back, we're going to get into it on some immigration stuff and very important reforms that were announced this week by the Obama administration. We're also asking you about name change for Broward County. Should Broward County change its name? This was a conversation that is going to be brought up among commission members and leaders next week when we put out a query through the Public Insight Network. And later on in the show, we'll hear from you, the listeners, via the phone and some from social networking on whether you think Broward needs to change its name. I'm Phil Latzman. We're coming back with more of the Florida Roundup in just a moment. And I'm Phil Latzman. Welcome back. It is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Our guest today, Chuck Strauss from the Miami New Times. Also, McNelly Torres from the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting and Patricia Mazzei from the Miami Herald. And we'll take some of your feedback a little bit later on as we go here on the program. Some very significant developments, McNelly, in immigration reform this week. New rules issued by the Department of Homeland Security and the Obama administration regarding illegal immigrants with family in the U.S. Plenty of those, obviously, in South Florida who can now become permanent residents more easily. What happened?
You know, I think that this is just the few steps that the Obama administration is going to be taking, you know, this year. The president is already, you know, hinting as much that he will move in full force to push for immigration, comprehensive immigration reform as early as this month. So these are probably the first steps and changes as, you know, they all rally together and try to, to build this comprehensive immigration reform bill. And, you know, last month, you know, of course, we all know that one of the biggest outcomes of the presidential election this year was that the Latino vote is strong and it will continue to grow strong. Over 70% of Latinos voted for President Obama. A big percentage of Asians too. So everybody is expecting that immigration reform will be tackled this year. And last month, the largest Latino groups warned Congress. They all had this public press conference where they basically warned Congress that they are expecting this year that Congress will tackle comprehensive immigration reform and that this bill will pass. And that not only that, that they are going to keep a report card on lawmakers who are not supporting comprehensive immigration. I think yesterday a group of immigrant activists went to Senator Rubio's office and urged him to support in comprehensive immigration. We are going to see more of that in the weeks and months to come.
The developments of this week, beginning March 4th, illegal immigrants who can demonstrate that time apart from an American spouse, child, or parent would create extreme hardship can apply for a visa without leaving the U.S., once approved, applicants would be able to require to briefly leave in order to return to their native country and pick up their visas. And the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, by the way, this is obviously going to be something that the Obama administration is going to concentrate on. But the Obama administration has been just aggressively deporting illegal immigrants previous to this, using a program meant for illegal immigrants who are violent criminals to deport those with no criminal background. They have been about as aggressive as any administration ever.
Yes, they have. For those conservatives who said that the president has not been tough on undocumented immigrants, I try to be very careful about how I use my terms. I don't like that illegal immigrant or illegal alien. I think it's degrading to people, undocumented immigrants. And yes, we did a story about that and how.
And that was my. I will correct myself on that too. Referring to it that way.
Yeah, he has been very, very tough. And actually, you know, a lot of people have been deported under this program, which is Secure Communities program that was designed to identify and deport undocumented immigrants with criminal backgrounds. Many people who have been deported in the past few years have no criminal background whatsoever. The only crime was that they were here illegally.
So Florida has about 700,000 undocumented immigrants. Chuck, you think this is a meaningful change?
I think it's just window dressing. I think the major failure of the Obama administration, Minnelli used the word tough. I would use the word failure. You know, Obama let down every immigrant in this country in his first 4 years. I don't think we're going to see any kind of legislation because I think the Republicans are going to oppose it. Moreover, you know, we did a story or I did a series of columns about a guy who was thrown out of the country, spent his entire life here because he stole a pair of shoes. He walked out of a store wearing a pair of shoes. I mean, the Obama administration has been so bad in terms of immigrants. It's unbelievable. And I don't think we're going to see anything different in the next 3 or 4 years.
Well, moving on to some state stuff, Governor Rick Scott, you could say, won his office by being tough on immigration or pretending, at least at the time in the Republican primaries, that he was going to be the guy that cracked down on immigration and in Florida. He begins his third year in office, and that really has not been much of an issue here in the state of Florida as far as what he's done with that. But he has approval ratings of 36%, according to more recent polls. Yesterday, near his home in Naples, the governor was asked about his priorities for the state lawmaking session in March.
We care about making sure people can get a job, make sure people get a great education, make sure we keep the cost of living low, and also have low crime rate. As you all know, we're at a 41-year low in our crime rate.
So the focus seems to be on education, less on tax cuts. the Affordable Care Act will become an issue as the governor meets with the U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius, on Monday to discuss all of this. Pat, Patricia, you have any insights on what's going on with this? And you've covered state, local, regional on health care. What's being said?
Did you just call me Pat there?
I'm sorry about that and left out the I.
Well, certainly talking about education and job creation, I think, is more palatable to voters. We've seen the governor kind of massage his position on health care since the U.S. Supreme Court let the law stand. I mean, that was a lawsuit brought in part by Florida and Attorney General Pam Bondi. And after losing, you know, everyone kind of calibrated their opposition to it. So we're going to see where that goes. It's important, you know, for Dade County in particular because of Jackson Memorial Hospital,
right,
and whether they'll be getting Medicaid dollars from the state under the new law. So that's going to be big on the radar. Interesting that he didn't mention insurance, because certainly in South Florida, you know, the citizens' situation is something that the local legislators have really taken on, sometimes bucking their own party, the Republicans, certainly, in talking about the need to you know, get out some of the waste from citizens and help people out as opposed to push them onto the private providers.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's a major issue we've all dealt with. Chuck?
Can I also say that Rick Scott is a total hypocrite, that this is the guy who cut education extraordinarily, and now he's coming back and he's saying, we've got to build education, we got to work on it. Well, he did more than any single political person in the state to really ruin the reforms that his fellow Republican Jeb Bush had instituted, which rocketed Florida up in terms of national rankings.
Yeah, we just got a new education commissioner, Mr. Tony Bennett, no relation with the singer.
Such a great name.
I know.
Easy to remember.
Easy to remember, definitely. This guy, you know, lost his election in Indiana, and, you know, he's a big supporter of vouchers and charter schools. And, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, we last year we saw a lot of uproar because of the FCAT, and parents all over the state, you know, want to, you know, see changes in the public school system. And I think that the Governor Scott sees this as an opportunity. I think he's looking at his reelection bid.
You want to talk about how Charlie Crist fits into all that. And the New Times has a little expose coming up on Charlie Crist, which Chuck will talk about in just a moment, though. David from North Miami Beach is on the line talking about Governor Scott and some state stuff. Hi, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Hi, David.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
So my question is, Governor seems to have created two different goals on jobs, 0.7 million in 7 years or 1.7 million jobs in 7 years. Is either one on track?
PolitiFact Florida has rated this right now a work in progress. And Patty, I don't know if you've seen anything different. It's hard to keep track of 700,000 in 7 years when you haven't gotten there yet. But there's been job creation in the state, and certainly Rick Scott has been the first to take credit for it at this point.
Well, yeah, and there was some question, too, as to what exactly the measurement was. You know, was it on top of regular job creation or as part of kind of the projected job creation? So this
is supposed
all
to be
kind of
700,000 on top,
right,
of what was originally expected. And I know from talking to Amy Sherman from PolitiFact Florida this week that that is something they're going to be tracking very carefully this year because it's been 2 years. So,
and leading up to 2014 with the gubernatorial,
right,
election, we'll get to the nitty gritty of the number.
Exactly. That'll be the major issue for next year.
Yeah, we still have a high unemployment rate in the state. And, you know, and I wonder from those jobs that have been created, how many of those are low-wage jobs? And, you know, I heard the clip from the governor talking about, you know, cost of living. I mean, cost of living in Florida is pretty high. And, you know, when you have a low-wage job, I mean, it's hard out there for a lot of families to make ends meet. And I think it will continue to be like that for a while.
Yeah, and there was a slight minimum wage increase in the state, but not much.
Couple of cents.
Yeah. David, thanks very much for your call.
Thanks.
I'm sorry we couldn't completely answer that. I don't know if the answer's there yet, but I'm sure that those are things will be discussed over the next few months. Chuck, you do have a story in the New Times about Charlie Crist dishing some dirt, new dirt, if you will, on the new Democrat next week. What you
We're
got?
Not dishing dirt, Phil. We're telling stories, okay?
Yeah. Okay.
But we have a long investigation, a 2-month investigation or profile, if you will, of Charlie Crist, who's kind of the new flavor in national politics, coming out next week by a new staff writer named Terry McCoy. It looks back at Mr. Crist's youth as well as at his recent speech at the Democratic convention and conversion to becoming a Democrat. Turns out that about his father was a member of the school board in Pinellas County and resigned abruptly after the St. Pete Times called him the nearest thing to a supporter of apartheid. He was a strong, his political career ended way back when he was the strongest opponent of desegregating schools there. That hasn't been talked about.
And sins of the father, though, are they sins of the son?
We discussed this earlier. Charles Crist, Charlie's dad, is his single most important political advisor. Moreover, Charlie talks a lot about how he was a great football star at Wake Forest. In his speech at the Democratic National Convention, he talked about when I was a quarterback down the road at Wake Forest. Well, it turns out he was on the practice squad. He never made the varsity. And it you know, maybe these things are small, Phil, but they're symptomatic of a guy who has often changed his position.
Chameleon is what you're getting at.
Exactly. And I think it's interesting. We were just talking about Rick Scott because I think the economy's going to improve. Rick Scott's approval ratings are going to go up in the next 6-month year. And I think Charlie, who's 2 dozen points, I believe, above Rick Scott in polls recently, is going to fall because people are going to remember why they didn't like him and why they voted against him in the Marco Rubio race. It's going to be a very interesting next year, I think.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. It's Chuck Strauss from the Miami News Times, and you look forward to that story in that publication next week. Patty Mazzei is working on a whole bunch of different stories, and she's constantly busy with stuff. And one of the stories that you've been working on, also with us, by the way, McNelly Torres, and we're going to talk to her about some other stuff as well. But, Patty, one of the things you... In fact, we're going to call you Front Page Patty from now on, as we discussed. You do have the story today about structural worries on a major bridge that links Key Biscayne with Virginia Key. And this has been a big public radio topic over the past week for those that have been listening about the structural integrity of bridges and infrastructure all around the country. And we have one example right here in our neck of the woods of a possibly dangerous bridge.
Well, it's the Bear Cut Bridge, which links Virginia Key to Key Biscayne, as you said, and the county decided to close down the westbound lanes because there are some structural problems with the steel beams, the girders underneath the surface of the bridge, and they're corroded. This isn't new. It's apparently the problem has been accelerated over the past 6 months, and so the Florida Department of Transportation recommended putting some weight restrictions on heavy vehicles crossing the bridge. But that caused all sort of problems because, you know, if you can't get delivery to the Publix on Key Biscayne, or maybe you could only limit trucks to certain hours of the day. So in the end, the county said, you know, we're just going to close down the westbound lanes and open one lane going each way, inbound and outbound, on the eastbound lanes. So this morning, traffic was, you know, not at a standstill, kind of moving along slowly. But granted, it's school hasn't gotten back into session. So we got to see Monday how that looks. There were a lot of cops out there. And mostly it was confusion for cyclists who are being now rerouted to the walled off pathway usually used kind of by leisurely cyclists and joggers and pedestrians. So there's some unhappiness in the cycling community over that.
And there's also been a lot of accidents with Aaron Cohen, accidents along not that particular stretch, but in that along the Rickenbacker Causeway. So that has also caused some issues.
Well, they are allowed to use the westbound bike lane on the way back because, you know, the bridge can handle cars and bikes. It's just trucks that are the problem. So we're going to see how the issue with the cyclists ends up being resolved, if at all.
But in a larger issue, as you also point out in your story today, this 11.5% of 70,000 bridges around the country are deemed structurally deficient. we really don't know, you know, specifically yet. We know this bridge, the Bear Cut Bridge, but how many we have in our region, in the entire area that we could be driving over that are not structurally sound?
Florida is actually on the lower end of the national rankings. Their infrastructure is better than a lot of other states.
Maybe because the roads are newer, causeways and things.
Yeah, it's in the worst, you know, offenders. Florida's not on that list because we checked it last night. We know we have some structurally deficient bridges. That doesn't mean they're unsafe or that they require to be closed. FDOT checks everything every 2 years, and if things have problems, they have to check them more often. But, you know, it's a national problem for sure.
Is that one thing we don't have to worry about here, is bridges crumbling underneath us, Chuck?
I'm originally from Minneapolis, where the bridge crumbled, right? And people were killed in the river. They got high bridges up north. Here, I think our bigger problem is Marco Rubio.
bridges have been a problem for a long time. You know, I when I was in South Carolina, I did a series on that, you know, and I analyzed all that data on the inspection data on the bridges across the nation. And that has been, you know, maintenance is a big issue. If you don't maintain these bridges on a constant level, you know, you are going to have some structural problems over time.
Yeah, so. And I know living from Westchester County, knowing that the Tappan Zee Bridge is always a topic of discussion, that mm-hmm. bridge will one day have problems or perhaps fall down, and that would certainly be something that would be awful. Patricia, before, what do I call Patricia? It's so formal. Patty, you, this also this week.
Front page Patty.
Oh, God, I'm cringing.
So you've also written this week about Rebecca Sosa, the chair of the Miami-Dade County Commission, the commission's first Hispanic chairwoman, a breast cancer survivor, and has also had some sort of controversial votes along the way to get her to the chairmanship job here.
Well, she voted for the Marlin Stadium deal, which... she somehow managed to not get the same wrath that some of the other commissioners did for that vote, in part because she also didn't kind of support some of the other controversial issues that led to the recall of former Mayor Carlos Alvarez and former Commissioner Natasha Cejas. So she's managed to kind of get, you know, in the middle of the road there and please all sides. For example, she backed putting term limits for commissioners on the ballot, and so she's seen as a reformer on that end. But she voted for the stadium, you know. I mean, these are things that might upset some people. It's going to be an interesting dynamic now because she's seen much more as an ally of Mayor Carlos Jimenez than the previous chairman, Joe Martinez, was. So I'm not sure that we're going to see the same kind of counterweight to the administration. There's 13 commissioners, so who knows how that will go. But it's going to be a new dynamic in the next couple of years.
Rebecca Sosa, I guess, once was the mayor of West Miami, and I think her claim to fame is having given Marco Rubio his political break, his big political break to get him involved in this profession. New members of the commission, changes in Florida's largest county. This is primarily what you do. You cover Miami-Dade County government. What else do we look forward to in 2013?
Well, they're still kind of wrangling over the election problems, and they're going to be poring over the election department's report, which finally came out right before Christmas. And Monday, that's going to be something this elections advisory group is going to be taking up. And they admitted to kind of a lot of local problems here. I mean, there's state issues as well, but, you know, they got to tackle things, and they're going to cost money. If you want to get electronic sign-in registries at all of the polls on Election Day, we're talking about $5 million right there. So this is going to be an ongoing budgetary and policy issue for the commission.
Well, one thing that they will not be talking about is changing the name of Miami-Dade County, but they will be talking about that in Broward next week. And when we come back, and this week we asked you via the Public Insight Network, should Broward change its name? Should it need an identity change in that form? Well, we will talk to you about that through the Public Insight Network and through our phones. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. We're back in just a moment. Well,
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman, reintroducing our panel, McNelly Torres from the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, Patricia Mazet from the Miami Herald, and Chuck Strauss from the Miami New Times, also the Broward and Palm Beach New Times. And we've been sort of talking about, and by the way, we should mention that our online discussion continues. We are followable. You can follow us on Twitter at WLRN. Everybody has their own Twitter addresses. I know, McNelly, you're Watchdog Diva.
Yes.
On Twitter. Patricia Mazet, you're just Patricia Mazet, right?
Want to spell how boring.
It? Well, that's pretty
change
normal.
Change
it
to Front Page Patty.
Front Page Patty, not bad.
Patricia, Mazzei.
And Chuck, you are El Jefe? No, what are you?
Chuck Strauss.
Chuck Strauss, yeah. And I'm Philatzman, because nobody can ever spell my name. speaking of nobody remembering or spelling a name right, I heard somebody say to me yesterday, you live in Broward County? And I said, no, it's Broward County. Anyway, so this week, in fact, next week, there will be a meeting among Broward County leaders to discuss whether or not they should change the name of the county. And in fact, the New Times asked its readers what the Broward should be named instead. We asked our listeners and readers through the Public Insight Network what they thought about changing Broward's name, and we'll hear what New Times came up with. I have a feeling there's going to be some snark in there. I'm not sure. but we'll find out first what some of the folks on the Public Insight Network this week told us. Elizabeth, do we have you from Fort Lauderdale? Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome to the Florida Roundup. And I know you've worked to promote Broward as a location for film and television producers. So what do you think? Is Broward a place that's identifiable?
Not at all. Not at all. For external marketing, it's got to be Fort Lauderdale or Lauderdale. Internally, of course, is possibly a different story. But it was hysterical. I would go the first time I went to a trade show in Los Angeles, of course, they put me between Miami-Dade and Palm Beach. And we had to have our counties above us. And, of course, my county was Broward. I can tell you from then on, I became Broward / Fort Lauderdale because it was very confusing. They would all walk up to me and say, Broward, where is that?
Well, Broward, by the way, Napoleon Bonaparte Broward, 19th governor of Florida. I guess a lot of people don't know that. Also served as the sheriff of Duval County, so he was not even a South Floridian. I guess.
And the architect of draining the Everglades
right.
And building upon them, he was among the greatest environmental crooks that the state has ever had, and among the worst people for our environment. And good for them for naming their county after.
So, McNelly, do you want to respond to Elizabeth? She says it's got to be done.
I travel around the country, too, and I always have to, explain people, Broward for Lauderdale. I think the new Chamber of Commerce is using the greater for Lauderdale. Why do we need to change the name? Is now a good time for this? This is going to cost money. Do we have the budget for this? I mean, I just
Well, shall I remind you that Miami-Dade changed its name about 15 years ago, right? It used to be Metro-Dade County.
Metro-Dade County, and it became Miami-Dade County.
And there was some controversy at the time. I read some of the clips this week when I saw the Lauderdale news, and people were really upset that there was a major kind of lobbying effort behind pushing for the change, and some like 12,000 people voted. It was tiny turnout. And then some people wanted to go back to just Dade. So these things are always kind of fun.
I remember that happened, and it cost several hundred thousand dollars. Elizabeth, thank you very much for your call. It cost several hundred thousand dollars to change the stationery, and people were up in arms about how they had
signs.
Well,
it was a war because they created a mayor of Dade County or of Miami-Dade County, and the mayor of Dade County wanted to be more important than the mayor of Miami. So it was, as everything in South Florida, it was one big ego against another.
Against the other.
Now, we have another Broward-Adian. What do we call somebody from Broward?
Broward-ate.
Broward-ate. That sounds about
I have no idea. I live in Broward. I don't even know.
Exactly. Justin is in Hollywood, and he's on with us through the Public Insight Network. Hi, Jason. Justin, rather. So what's the first word that pops into your mind when you hear Lauderdale?
Before I moved down here, when I thought of Fort Lauderdale, I still thought of spring break. So I think that, some of the name recognition that people down here say Fort Lauderdale has might not be shared with the rest of the country.
So do you think that Lauderdale, would you be for or against this name change being from Hollywood? How about Hollywood County, by the way? I live in Hollywood. You know,
I would like that. I'm against it just because I think that there's so much more to Broward County, especially living in Hollywood. I think we have our own unique character as some of the other cities, such as Pompano Beach. These are large cities that people outside this area know as well, and it would sort of subordinate some of these cities to Fort Lauderdale and start to feel like we're all suburbs of Fort Lauderdale.
Hmm. Justin, thanks very much for your call. Very, very interesting viewpoint on that. All right, let's go to Kim, who is in Plantation. She is a realtor. All right, so you would have a vested interest in this, selling properties in Lauderdale County. Would that be better than selling them in Broward County, Kim?
Well, yes. When I first heard about the move to kind of change the name, I was thinking, wow, how exciting, because now I won't have to tell clients that, you know, this property is in Broward County. Like, where? You know, what's that? Because if I say Miami-Dade, yes, everyone identifies Miami-Dade. Broward is kind of like, we're still not sure, but then when you say near Fort Lauderdale, oh, yeah, we know where that is. So I think for reinventing the whole area as a new world-class destination, I think that's where we are trying to get with this whole thing, is I think that would be a great step forward to creating that awareness of where we are, Lauderdale, Fort Lauderdale, this whole South Florida area. This is where we're at. This is a great place to be.
You think the members of the Broward County Commission that will be discussing this next, I think it's next Thursday, I believe, on the 10th of January, think they're listening to this, Chuck Winnie?
I think they need comedy writers. If I was on the Broward County Commission, I'd be hiring somebody to make me some good jokes.
All right, so now, Kim, we have to, Chuck's got his own suggestions, and again, slightly possibly on the acerbic side here, of what might be, what might be his suggestions.
I'm not going to give away what's in the paper next week, okay? But let me just say, I do have comedy writers. Now, I mean, we were sort of been bouncing around ideas for what would be better. We thought Napoleon Bonaparte Broward. Let's go with that. Let's call it, I don't know, Drain the Everglades County. What do you think of that one? Or another one we kind of came up with was At Least We Won't Eat Your Face County.
Oh.
Oh, sorry, that was a sick one. Sorry.
Yeah.
We also thought something like maybe The Road to Browware. I don't know. Maybe that one won't work.
Browweird?
Broco? I don't know. We've been working on. We'll have a whole collection.
You got to keep working on it. I think
you're right.
You got
we need some more
work to do.
Tough
there.
Audience. Tough audience.
Justin, thanks. Or excuse me, Kim. Thanks for your call.
You know, the reality is that people are horrible at geography in this country. I mean, they can't pinpoint one state from the other. I don't think it would matter whether it's called Lauderdale and Broward. There's gonna be some people, even though that we are on the national news all the time, they're not gonna know where we are.
Rob is going to chime in. He's also in my hometown of Hollywood. Hi, Rob. Welcome to the Florida Roundup.
Hey, how's everybody doing today?
We're doing good. So you think there'd be any benefit to changing Broward to Lauderdale County?
You know, being born and raised here, I got to tell you, people, you know, go to a destination. For example, people don't go to the farthest south city in Monroe County. They go to Key West. People don't go to Clark County, Nevada. They go to Las Vegas. So as far as my opinion, if you call it Lauderdale County, then what happens to all the other cities that are involved, you know, Davie, Cooper City, Weston, and all these other cities? And then let's go to the police, where you have Broward Sheriff's Office. Now it becomes Lauderdale Sheriff's Office. So to me, it's going to look like it's more...
But that's not unlike. It's not unlike that. Other cities have the same issue where you're in a city. I'm trying to think of one now. New York. But it's not, you know, the name of the county and the city, the largest city in the county are the same.
The thing is, go on.
I'm sorry to interrupt. But like, for example, you know, we both have kids, Phil. So we don't take the kids to Orange County, Florida. We go to Orlando. You don't go to Hillsborough County.
Totally agree with you.
You know, Busch Gardens, Tampa. If you want to change the name to a county to attract more people, first of all, the name Florida in general tells people you're on a peninsula. Number one, you're surrounded by water. You want to change the county, change it to like Ocean County,
right.
Seaview County, Seabreeze County, something other than Lauderdale. Because Lauderdale, like I said, it's like an isolated name where unless you change every city's name in Broward County to Lauderdale, then it would make sense.
Well, Rob, thanks very much for your call.
Thanks, Bill.
Heard for and against there. Very, very interesting discussion we had. Thanks to the Public Insight Network. And by the way, please become a pinhead, because it's really important. I mean, this is our way to remember the PIN, Public Insight Network. Become a pinhead. Go to WLRN.org/insight and sign up with your information, your name, where we can contact you, and we get you on the show, just like those informed listeners that we just heard there. Join the Public Insight Network. Before we go, a couple of other things. Hugo Chavez remains in Cuba with what are now being called severe respiratory complications following cancer surgery. Might not even be able to take the oath of office in Caracas on January 10th. He's been in Cuba since the surgery on December 11th. Patty, you are of Venezuelan descent. In fact, you voted in the elections this past year. What's the feeling in your community, in the Venezuelan community, about what's going on with Hugo Chavez?
Well, it's a constant rumor mill, as you can imagine, just of what the latest is. I don't even want to think of you know, January 10th and what could happen there. I mean, it's really awful to be in this situation. I mean, someone being sick and the leader of a country and the flow of information being, you know, very limited, coming from official sources. You know, it's a very tight-lipped situation. And no, you know, people just kind of start rumor-mongering, which I just think is awful when it's about somebody's health. So it's, you know, tense.
And so if he does not end up in the country on January 10th, he can't take the oath of office. They have to hold new elections? Is that what happens?
Well, I'm sure they're looking at every possible way of trying to get him to take that oath of office.
Whether it's in Cuba or flying him back on a gurney? Or
who knows? I mean, I'm sure that's on the table. Between now and then, it's going to be just minute, hour by hour, just what is the latest and you know, we don't know.
Now, huge population of Venezuelans in South Florida, many of them in places like Doral and Weston. What would change? I mean, what could dramatically change if Hugo Chavez dies?
Well, there would be he's appointed someone who would be his kind of successor if there would be an election afterwards. But I still think there would be some sort of power struggle just from a lot of people who've had to keep their ambitions under wraps for 14 years that he's been in power. And so the question would be, what would happen in a potential new election? And would people, you know, be happy with a new government? And would they move back? Would they move from Venezuela to here? I mean, it's just a lot of questions right now.
Well, we'll put a comma there and continue the discussion. We also want to talk to you about and tell you that we have a very special week planned for our third-year anniversary of the earthquake in Port-au-Prince in Haiti. It marks 3 years next Saturday since that earthquake, and next week we're bringing you a five-part series of stories about a young woman named Fabienne Jean, who was a promising dancer living in Port-au-Prince. She had performed with Haiti's biggest band. She'd even danced at the country's national theater, but then the earthquake hit, and everything changed.
I was watching TV. I felt the house start to shake. I ran outside. I stopped by a wall in front of the house. When the ground continued to shake, I ran. I fell to the ground. I took a towel and I put my leg in it.
And we're going to bring you Fabienne Jean's story all next week. Tune in to WLRN during Morning Edition and All Things Considered for that series. And on a final note, we found out that Miami had the distinction this week, Chuck, of staying up later than any other city on New Year's Eve.
Well, they measured this through cell phone traffic, and they found that people were using their cell phones later, and this was adjusted for the Eastern, Central, and Western time zones, that Miami people were on their cell phones. No surprise there. What was a surprise is that Southern California is a bunch of wimps. They all went to bed early. So,
well, once it happens on the East Coast, you know, it's no fun on the West Coast 3 hours later. But another distinction from Miami, dubious or not, that does it for the Florida Roundup on this Friday, January 4th, 2013. Thanks to Chuck Strauss, Miami New Times editor. Always good to see you, Chuck. Thanks for coming in.
Great to see you, Phil.
Patricia Mazzei, Miami Herald, very busy, as we call her, front page Patty. Thank you. Thank you, ma'am. She's going to hate me after this show. I know. She's going to kill me. Hey, thanks, Patty.
Thanks, Phil.
And McNelly Torres is with the Florida Center Center for Investigative Reporting. You can read her work and many other hardworking people at fcir.org. Thanks, McNally.
Thank you so much, and Happy New Year to everybody.
Happy New Year to everyone. If you missed any of the show, you can listen again on these airwaves tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. We also post it on our website, wlrn.org. We're produced by Alicia Zuckerman, Elaine Chan, our associate producer. Our executive producer for WLRN is Peter J. Meritz. For WLRN News, Miami Herald News, Dan Gretsch. Thanks to technical supervisor Paul Leary. South Florida Arts Beat is next. I'm Phil Latzman. Stay informed, South Florida.